8. L. Antiques, for there are many counterfeits they buy at an extravagant price, giving sometimes no less than L. 300 sterling for one of them. The bedroom is divided from the saloon by a partition of folding doors, which, when the weather is hot, are in the night thrown open to admit the air. It is very small, and contains no other furniture than the bed, and some varnished chests in which they keep their apparel. The beds are very magnificent. The bedsteads are made much like ours in Europe of rosewood, carved, or lacquered work. The curtains are of taffeta or gauze, sometimes flowered with gold, and commonly either blue or purple. About the top a slit of white satin, a foot in breadth, runs all round, on which are painted, in panels, different figures, flower pieces, landscapes, and conversation pieces, interspersed with moral sentences and fables written in Indian ink and vermilion, from old paintings and engravings which date from about the 14th or 15th century. One gathers an idea of such furniture as existed in China and Japan in earlier times. In one of these, which is reproduced in Racinet's Lee Costume Historic, there is a Chinese princess reclining on a sofa which has a frame of black wood visible, and slightly ornamented. It is upholstered with rich embroidery, for which these artistic people seem to have been famous from a very early period. A servant stands by her side to hand her the pipe of opium with which the monotony of the day was varied. One arm rests on a small wooden table or stand which is placed on the sofa, and which holds a flower vase and a pipe stand. On another old painting, two figures are seated on mats playing a game which resembles draughts, the pieces being moved about on a little table with black and white squares like a modern chessboard, with shaped feet to raise it a convenient height for the players. On the floor stand cups of tea ready to hand. Such pictures are generally ascribed to the 15th century, the period of the Great Ming Dynasty, which appears to have been the time of an improved culture and taste in China. From this time and a century later, the 16th, also date those beautiful cabinets of lacquered wood enriched with ivory, mother of pearl, with silver and even with gold, which have been brought to England occasionally, but genuine specimens of this, and of the 17th century, are very scarce and extremely valuable. The older Chinese furniture which one sees generally in Europe dates from the 18th century, and was made to order and imported by the Dutch. This explains the curious combination to be found of Oriental and European designs. Thus, there are screens with views of Amsterdam and other cities copied from paintings sent out for the purpose, while the frames of the panels are of carved rosewood of the fretted bamboo pattern characteristic of the Chinese. Elaborate bedsteads, tables and cabinets were also made, with panels of ash stained a dark color and ornamented with hunting scenes, in which the men and horses are of ivory, or sometimes with ivory faces and limbs, the clothes being chiefly in a brown-colored wood. In a beautiful table in the South Kensington Museum, which is said to have been made in Cochin China, mother of pearl is largely used and produces a rich effect. The furniture brought back by the Duke of Edinburgh from China and Japan is of the usual character imported, and the remarks hereafter made on Indian or Bombay furniture apply equally to this adaptation of Chinese detail to European designs. The most highly prized work of China and Japan in the way of decorative furniture is the beautiful lacquer work. And in the notice on French furniture of the 18th century, in a subsequent chapter, we shall see that the process was adopted in Holland, France and England with more or less success. It is worthwhile, however, to allude to it here a little more fully. The process as practiced in China is thus described by Anne Jacquemart. The wood, when smoothly planed, is covered with a sheet of thin paper or silk gauze, over which is spread a thick coating made of powdered red sandstone and buffalo's gall. This is allowed to dry, after which it is polished and rubbed with wax, or else receives a wash of gum water, holding chalk in solution. The varnish is laid on with a flat brush, and the article is placed in a damp drying room, whence it passes into the hands of the workman, who moistens and again polishes it with a piece of very fine-grained soft clay slate, or with the stalks of the horsetail or shave grass. It then receives a second coating of lacquer, and when dry is once more polished. These operations are repeated until the surface becomes perfectly smooth and lustrous. There are never applied less than 3 coatings and seldom more than 18, though some old Chinese and some Japan ware are said to have received upwards of 20. As regards China, this seems quite exceptional, for there is in the Louvre a piece with the legend Lu Tinzi, i.e. 6 coatings, implying that even so many are unusual enough to be worthy of special mention. There is as much difference between different kinds and qualities of lac as between different classes of marcoopcri. The most highly prized is the lacquer on gold ground, and the specimens of this which first reached Europe during the time of Louis XV, were presentation pieces from the Japanese princes to some of the Dutch officials. Gold ground lacquer is rarely found in furniture, and only as a rule in some of those charming little boxes, in which the luminous effect of the lac is heightened by the introduction of silver foliage on a minute scale, or of tiny landscape work and figures charmingly treated, partly with dull gold and partly highly burnished. Small plaques of this beautiful ware were used for some of the choicest pieces of Bouvier's elegant furniture made for Marie Antoinette. A venture in lacquer closely imitates in color the sparkling mineral from which it takes its name, and a less highly finished preparation is used as a lining for the small drawers of cabinets. Another lacquer has a black ground, on which landscapes delicately traced in gold stand out in charming relief. Such pieces were used by Riesener and mounted by Gauvier in some of the most costly furniture made for Marie Antoinette. Some specimens are in the Louvre. It is this kind of lacquer, in varying qualities, that is usually found in cabinets, folding screens, coffers, tables, etagères, and other ornamental articles of furniture, enriched with inlay of mother of pearl, the effect of which is in some cases heightened and rendered more effective by some transparent coloring on its reverse side, as in the case of a bird's plumage or of those beautiful blossoms which both Chinese and Japanese artists can represent so faithfully. A very remarkable screen in Chinese lacquer of later date is in the South Kensington Museum. It is composed of 12 folds each 10 feet high, and measuring when fully extended 21 feet. This screen is very beautifully decorated on both sides with incised and raised ornaments painted and gilt on black ground, with a rich border ornamented with representations of sacred symbols and various other objects. The price paid for it was L1,000. There are also in the museum some very rich chairs of modern Chinese work, in brown wood, probably teak, very elaborately inlaid with mother of pearl. They were exhibited in Paris in 1867. Of the very early history of Japanese industrial arts we know but little. We have no record of the kind of furniture which Marco Polo found when he traveled in Japan in the 13th century, and until the Jesuit missionaries obtained a footing in the 16th century and sent home specimens of native work, there was probably very little of Japanese manufacture which found its way to Europe. The beautiful lacquer work of Japan, which dates from the end of the 16th and the following century, leads us to suppose that a long period of probation must have occurred before the arts, which were probably learned from the Chinese, could have been so thoroughly mastered. Of furniture, with the exception of the cabinets, chests, and boxes, large and small, of this famous lac, there appears to have been little, until the Japanese developed a taste for copying European customs and manners. The habit seems to have been to sit on mats and to use small tables raised a few inches from the ground. Even the bedrooms contained no bedsteads, but a light mattress served for bed and bedstead. The process of lacquering has already been described, and in the chapter on French furniture of the 18th century it will be seen how specimens of this decorative material reached France by way of Holland, and were mounted into the meubles de luxe of that time. With this exception, and that of the famous collection of porcelain in the Japan Palace at Dresden, probably but little of the art products of this artistic people had been exported until the country was opened up by the expedition of Lord Elgin and Commodore Perry, in 1858-9, and subsequently by the antiquarian knowledge and research of Sir Rutherford Alcock, who has contributed so much to our knowledge of Japanese industrial art. Indeed, it is scarcely too much to say that so far as England is concerned, he was the first to introduce the products of the Empire of Japan. The revolution and the breakup of the feudal system which had existed in that country for some 800 years, ended by placing the Mikado on the throne. There was a sale in Paris, in 1867, of the famous collection of the Shogun, who had sent his treasurers there to raise funds for the civil war in which he was then engaged with the Daimyo. This was followed by the exportation of other fine native productions to Paris and London, but the supply of old and really fine specimens has, since about 1874, almost ceased, and, in default, the European markets have become flooded with articles of cheap and inferior workmanship, exported to meet the modern demand. The present government of Japan, anxious to recover many of the masterpieces which were produced in the best time, under the patronage of the native princes of the old regime, have established a museum at Tokyo, where many examples of fine lacquer work, which had been sent to Europe for sale, have been placed after repurchase, to serve as examples for native artists to copy, and to assist in the restoration of the ancient reputation of Japan. There is in the South Kensington Museum a very beautiful Japanese chest of lacquer work made about the beginning of the 17th century, the best time for Japanese art. It formerly belonged to Napoleon I and was purchased at the Hamilton Palace sale for L722. It is some 3 feet 3 inches long and 2 feet 1 inch high, and was intended originally as a receptacle for sacred Buddhist books. There are, most delicately worked onto its surface, views of the interior of one of the imperial palaces of Japan, and a hunting scene, mother of pearl, gold, silver, and aventurine, are all used in the enrichment of this beautiful specimen of inlaid work, and the lot plate is a representative example of the best kind of metal work as applied to this purpose. H.R.H. the Duke of Edinburgh has several fine specimens of Chinese and Japanese lacquer work in his collection, about the arrangement of which the writer had the honor of advising His Royal Highness, when it arrived some years ago at Clarence House. The earliest specimen is a reading desk, presented by the Mikado, with a slope for a book much resembling an ordinary bookrest, but charmingly decorated with lacquer in landscape subjects on the flat surfaces, while the smaller parts are diapered with flowers and caterfoils in relief of lac and gold. This is of the 16th century. The collections of the Earl of Elgin and Kincardine, Sir Rutherford Alcock, KCB Mr. Salting, Viscount Gough, and other well-known amateurs, contain some excellent examples of the best periods of Japanese artwork of the 17th and 18th centuries. The grotesque carving of the wonderful dragons and marvelous monsters introduced into furniture made by the Chinese and Japanese, and especially in the ornamental woodwork of the old temples, is thoroughly peculiar to these masters of elaborate design and skillful manipulation, and the low rate of remuneration, compared with our European notions of wages, enables work to be produced that would be impracticable under any other conditions. In comparing the decorative work on Chinese and Japanese furniture, it may be said that more eccentricity is affected by the latter than by the former in their designs and general decorative work. The Japanese joinery is unsurpassed, and much of the lattice work, admirable in design and workmanship, is so quaint and intricate that only by close examination can it be distinguished from finely cut fret work. Indian furniture, European influence upon Indian art and manufacturers has been of long duration. It was first exercised by the Portuguese and Dutch in the early days of the United East India Company, afterwards by the French, who established a trading company there in 1664, and since then by the English, the first charter of the old East India Company dating as far back as 1600. Thus European taste dominated almost everything of an ornamental character until it became difficult to find a decorative article the design of which did not in some way or other show the predominance of European influence over native conception. Therefore it becomes important to ascertain what kind of furniture, limited as it was, existed in India during the period of the Mughal Empire, which lasted from 1505 to 1739. When the invasion of the Persians under Kuli Khan destroyed the power of the Mughals, the country formerly subject to them was then divided amongst sundry petty princes. The thrones and state chairs used by the Mughals were rich with elaborate gilding, the legs or supports were sometimes of turned wood, with some of the members carved. The chair was formed like an hourglass, or rather like two bowls reversed, with the upper part extended to form a higher back to the seat. In Emra seen at sumptuous work, Lee Costume Historic, published in Paris in 20 volumes 1876. There are reproduced some old miniatures from the collection of M. Ambroise Didot. These represent with all the advantages of the most highly finished printing in gold, silver, and colors portraits of these native sovereigns seated on their state chairs, with the umbrella, as a sign of royalty. The panels and ornaments of the thrones are picked out with patterns of flowers, sometimes detached blossoms, sometimes the whole plant. The colors are generally bright red and green, while the ground of a panel or the back of a chair is in silver, with arabesque tracery, the rest of the chair being entirely gilt. The couches are rectangular, with four turned and carved supports, some 8 or 10 inches high, and also gilt, with the exception of small tables, which could be carried into the room by slaves, and used for the light refreshments customary to the country. There was no other furniture. The ladies of the harem are represented as being seated on sumptuous carpets, and the walls are highly decorated with gold and silver and color, which seems very well suited to the arched openings, carved and gilt doors, and brilliant costumes of the occupants of these Indian palaces. After the breakup of the Mughal power, the influence of Holland, France, and England brought about a mixture of taste and design which, with the concurrent alterations in manners and customs, gradually led to the production of what is now known as the Bombay furniture. The patient, minute carving of Indian design applied to utterly uncongenial Portuguese or French shapes of chairs and sofas, or to the familiar round or oval table, carved almost beyond recognition, are instances of this style. One sees these occasionally in the house of an Anglo-Indian, who has employed native workmen to make some of this furniture for him, the European chairs and tables being given as models. While the details of the ornament have been left to native taste, it is scarcely part of our subject to allude to the same kind of influence which has spoiled the quaint bizarre effect of native design and workmanship in silver, in jewelry, in carpets, embroideries, and in pottery, which was so manifest in the contributions sent to South Kensington at the Colonial Exhibition, 1886. There are in the Indian Museum at South Kensington several examples of this Bombay furniture, and also some of Singhalese manufacture. In the Jones collection at South Kensington Museum, there are two carved ivory chairs and a table, the latter gilded, the former partly gilded, which are a portion of a set taken from Tippu Saib at the storming of Seringapatam. Warren Hastings brought them to England, and they were given to Queen Charlotte. After her death the set was divided, Lord Londesborough purchased part of it, and this portion is now on loan at the Bethnal Green Museum. The Queen has also amongst her numerous jubilee presents some very handsome ivory furniture of Indian workmanship, which may be seen at Windsor Castle. These, however, as well as the Jones collection examples, though thoroughly Indian in character as regards the treatment of scrolls, flowers, and foliage, show unmistakably the influence of French taste in their general form and contour. Articles, such as boxes, stands for gongs, etc. are to be found carved in sandalwood, and in balbriggan, or blackwood, with rosewood moldings, and a peculiar characteristic of this Indian decoration, sometimes applied to such small articles of furniture, is the coating of the surface of the wood with red lacquer, the plain parts taking a high polish while the carved enrichment remains dull. The effect of this is precisely that of the article being made of red sealing wax. And frequently the minute pattern of the carved ornament and its general treatment tend to give an idea of an impression made in the wax by an elaborately cut die. The casket illustrated on page 134 is an example of this treatment. It was exhibited in 1851. The larger examples of Indian carved woodwork are of teak. The finest and most characteristic specimens within the writer's knowledge are the two folding doors which were sent as a present to the Indian government, and are in the Indian Museum. They are of 17th century work, and are said to have enclosed a library at Karolay. While the door frames are of teak, with the outer frames carved with bands of foliage in high relief, the doors themselves are divided into panels of fantastic shapes, and yet so arranged that there is just sufficient regularity to please the eye. Some of these panels are carved and enriched with ivory flowers, others have a rosette of carved ivory in the center, and pieces of talc with green and red color underneath, a decoration also found in some Arabian work. It is almost impossible to convey by words an adequate description of these doors. They should be carefully examined as examples of genuine native design and workmanship. Mr. Pollan has concluded a somewhat detailed account of them by saying, for elegance of shape and proportion, and the propriety of the composition of the frame and subdivisions of these doors, their moldings and their panel carvings and ornaments, we can for the present name no other example so instructive. We are much reminded by this decoration of the pierced lattices at the S. Marco in Venice. There is in the Indian Museum another remarkable specimen of native furniture, namely, a chair of the purest beaten gold of octagonal shape, and formed of two bowls reversed, decorated with a canthus and lotus in repoussé ornament. This is of 18th century workmanship, and was formerly the property of Ranjit Singh. The precious metal is thinly laid on, according to the Eastern method, the wood underneath the gold taking all the weight, There is also a collection of plaster casts of portions of temples and palaces from a very early period until the present time, several having been sent over as a loan to the Indian and Colonial Exhibition of 1886, and afterwards presented by the commissioners to the museum. A careful observation of the ornamental details of these casts leads us to the conclusion that the Byzantine style, which was dominant throughout the more civilized portion of Asia during the power of the Romans, had survived the great changes of the Middle Ages, as native work became subject more or less to the influence of the Indo-Chinese carvers of deities on the one side, and of the European notions of the Portuguese pioneers of discovery on the other. A fashion of decorative woodwork was arrived at which can scarcely be dignified by the name of a style, and which it is difficult to describe. Dr. Birdwood, in his work on Indian art, points out that, about 100 years ago, Indian designs were affected by the immigration of Persian designers and workmen. The result of this influence is to be seen in the examples in the museum, a short notice of which will conclude these remarks on Indian work. The copy in Shisham wood of a carved window at Amritsar, in the Punjab, with its overhanging cornice, ornamental arches, supported by pillars, and the whole surface covered with small details of ornament, is a good example of the 16th and 17th century work. The various facades of dwelling houses in teak wood, carved, and still bearing the remains of paint with which part of the carving was picked out, represent the work of the contemporary carvers of Ahmedabad, famous for its woodwork. Portions of the lacquer work screen, similar in appearance to embossed gilt leather, with the pattern in gold, on a ground of black or red, and the singular cashmere work, called mirror mosaic, give us a good idea of the Indian decoration of the 18th and early 19th centuries. This effective decoration is produced by little pieces of looking glass being introduced into the small geometrical patterns of the panels. These, when joined together, form a very rich ceiling. The bedstead of Kintiba, brought from Mandalay, is an example of this mixture of glass and wood, which can be made extremely effective. The wood is carved and gilt to represent the gold setting of numerous precious stones, which are counterfeited by small pieces of looking glass and variously colored pieces of transparent glass. Some of the Prince of Wales presents, namely, chairs, with carved lions forming arms, tables of Shisham wood, inlaid with ebony and ivory, show the European influence we have alluded to. Amongst the modern ornamental articles in the museum are many boxes, pen trays, writing cases, and even photograph albums of wood and ivory mosaic work, the inlaid patterns being produced by placing together strips of tin wire, sandalwood, ebony, and of ivory, white, or stained green. These bound into a rod, either triangular or hexagonal, are cut into small sections, and then inlaid into the surface of the article to be decorated. Papier-mâché and lacquer work are also frequently found in small articles of furniture, and the collection of drawings by native artists attests the high skill in design and execution attained by Indian craftsmen. Persia. The Persians have from time immemorial been an artistic people, and their style of art throughout successive conquests and generations has varied but little. Major General Murdoch Smith, R.E., the present director of the branch of the South Kensington Museum in Edinburgh, who resided for some years in Persia, and had the assistance when there of M. Richard, a well-known French antiquarian, made a collection of objets d'art some years ago for the Science and Art Department, which is now in the Kensington Museum. But it contains comparatively little that can be actually termed furniture, and it is extremely difficult to meet with important specimens of ornamental woodwork of native workmanship. Those in the museum, and in other collections, are generally small ornamental articles. The chief reason of this island doubtless, that little timber is to be found in Persia, except in the Caspian provinces, where, as Mr. Benjamin has told us, in Persia and the Persians, wood is abundant, and the Persian architect, taking advantage of his opportunity, has designed his houses with wooden piazzas not found elsewhere and with beams, lintels, and eaves quaintly, sometimes elegantly, carved, and tinted with brilliant hues. Another feature of the decorative woodwork in this part of Persia is that produced by the large latticed windows, which are well adapted to the climate. Illustration, door of carved sandalwood, from Travancore, India Museum, South Kensington, period, probably late XVII century. In the manufacture of textile fabrics notably, their famous carpets of Yezd and Isfahan, and their embroidered cloths in hammered and engraved metal work, and formerly in beautiful pottery and porcelain they have excelled, and examples will be found in the South Kensington Museum. It is difficult to find a representative specimen of Persian furniture except a box or a stool, and the illustration of a brass incense burner island therefore, given to mark the method of design, which was adopted in a modified form by the Persians from their Arab conquerors. This method of design has one or two special characteristics which are worth noticing. One of these was the teaching of Muhammad forbidding animal representation in design, a rule which in later work has been relaxed. Another was the introduction of mathematics into Persia by the Saracens, which led to the adoption of geometrical patterns in design, and a third, the development of calligraphy into a fine art, which has resulted in the introduction of a text, or motto, into so many of the Persian designs of decorative work. The combination of these three characteristics have given us the arabesque form of ornament, which, in artistic nomenclature, occurs so frequently. The general method of decorating woodwork is similar to that of India, and consists in either inlaying brown wood, generally teak, with ivory or pearl in geometrical patterns, or in covering the wooden box, or manuscript case, with a coating of lacquer, somewhat similar to the Chinese or Japanese preparations. On this groundwork some good miniature painting was executed, the colors being, as a rule, red, green, and gold, with black lines to give force to the design. The author of Persia and the Persians, already quoted, had, during his residence in the country, as American minister, great opportunities of observation, and in his chapter entitled A Glance at the Arts of Persia, has said a good deal of this mosaic work. Referring to the scarcity of wood in Persia, he says, "For the above reason one is astonished at the marvelous ingenuity, skill, and taste developed by the art of inlaid work, or mosaic in wood. It would be impossible to exceed the results achieved by the Persian artisans, especially those of Shiraz, in this wonderful and difficult art. Chairs, tables, sofas, boxes, violins, guitars, canes, picture frames, almost every conceivable object, in fact, which is made of wood, may be found overlaid with an exquisite casing of inlaid work, so many sometimes that 30 live or 40 pieces may be counted in the space of a square eighth of an inch. I have counted 428 distinct pieces on a square inch of a violin, which is completely covered by this exquisite detail of geometric designs. In mosaic, Mr. Benjamin, who, it will be noticed, is somewhat too enthusiastic over this kind of mechanical decoration, also observes that, while the details will stand the test of a magnifying glass, there is a general breadth in the design which renders it harmonious and pleasing if looked at from a distance. In the South Kensington Museum there are several specimens of Persian lacquer work, which have very much the appearance of papier-mâché articles that used to be so common in England some 40 years ago, save that the decoration island, of course, of Eastern character, of 17th century work. There is also a fine coffer, richly inlaid with ivory, of the best description of Persian design and workmanship of this period, which was about the zenith of Persian art during the reign of Shah Abbas. The numerous small articles of what is termed Persian marquetry are inlaid with tin wire and stained ivory on a ground of cedar wood, very similar to the same kind of ornamental work already described in the Indian section of this chapter. These were purchased at the Paris exhibition in 1867. Persian art of the present day may be said to be in a state of transition, owing to the introduction and assimilation of European ideas, Saracenic woodwork from Cairo and Damascus. While the changes of fashion in Western, as contrasted with Eastern countries, are comparatively rapid, the record of two or three centuries presenting a history of great and well-defined alterations in manners, customs, and therefore, of furniture, the more conservative Oriental has been content to reproduce, from generation to generation, the traditions of his forefathers, and we find that, from the time of the Moorish conquest and spread of Arabesque design, no radical change in Saracenic art occurred until French and English energy and enterprise forced European fashions into Egypt. As a consequence, the original quaintness and orientalism natural to the country are being gradually replaced by buildings, decoration, and furniture of European fashion. The carved pulpit from a mosque in Cairo, which is in the South Kensington Museum, was made for Sultan Kutbeg, 1468-96. The side panels, of geometrical pattern, though much injured by time and wear. Shoe signs of ebony inlaid with ivory, and of painting and gilding, they are good specimens of the kind of work. The Tudors, also from Cairo, the oldest parts of which are just 200 years earlier than the pulpit, are exactly of the same style, and, so far as appearances go, might be just as well taken for 200 years later. So conservative was the Saracenic treatment of decorative woodwork for some 4 or 5 centuries. Pentagonal and hexagonal mosaics of ivory, with little moldings of ebony dividing the different panels, the centers of eccentric shapes of ivory or rosewood carved with minute scrolls, combine to give these elaborate doors a very rich effect, and remind one of the work still to be seen at the Alhambra. The Science and Art Department has been fortunate in securing from the St. Maurice and Dr. Mimar collections a great many specimens which are well worth examination. The most remarkable is a complete room brought from a house in Damascus, which is fitted up in the Oriental style, and gives one a good idea of an Eastern interior. The walls are painted in color and gold, the spaces divided by flat pilasters, and there are recesses, or cupboards, for the reception of pottery, quaintly formed vessels, and pot.